Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Dodger fan, I hate to ask the question, but how you living right about now? How are you feeling this morning? I'm guessing pretty horribly. I can't imagine what the last 24 hours must have been like for you, Dodger fan. You know, you roll out yesterday, you've got that all-day grip working. You've got the all-day grip leading right up to the game, knowing that it could be one and done for this crew. And given the regular season they had, given the last few years, one and done in the NLDS would be a catastrophe. But at the same time, you knew that there was no way Walker Buehler was going to let that happen. Then the game starts. It could not have started any better than it did. Buehler goes 1-2-3. Then in the bottom of the first, Jock Peterson comes up.
Peterson leading off in the bottom of the first. He swings at a fly ball to deep left field. His way back, Soto at the wall, and it is gone. Well, yes, it is. It's gone. Soto is saying, wait a second.
Soto is saying the ball went between some uprights and the padding on the fence.
Well, it didn't take long to send Peterson back to second base.
Yeah, actually, it was not gone. Dodger radio on the call. No, that was not gone. That was a ground rule double. Nearly gone, not gone. But what Peterson did not do, Max Muncy did do.
3-1 to Muncy. Peterson leading off second. Swinging a fly ball to right. Well hit. Eaton back to the wall, and it is gone. Peterson a double. Muncy a home run. Dodgers 2-0.
2-0 Dodgers. And as filthy as Steven Strasburg had been, no sooner than he stepped into the ring last night, he started to eat punches. The Dodgers were landing at will, and it didn't look like Strasburg had any chance of defending himself. As I tweeted last night, the Dodgers had found their bats, and Strasburg was finding them as well with nearly every single pitch. Then in the bottom of the second, Kike Hernandez, who was a surprise addition to the lineup, jumped ship himself.
As Hernandez with a fly ball to center field. Fairly deep. It's really deep. And it is gone. Michael A. Taylor leaping at the wall. Couldn't reach it. Dodgers have a 3-0 lead.
That had just enough to get out and just enough to give the LA a 3-0 lead. And with the way Walker Buehler was pitching, 3-0 may as well have been 30-0. He was nasty. I mean, you talk about a guy ready for the moment. You talk about somebody built for the moment. This dude is a horse. He's the guy you want on the mound in that situation. A guy born for the moment. Nobody wants to be that guy more than Buehler. Nobody wants that ball more than him. And with each inning that he dominated, LA was getting closer and closer to partying. But then something happened. Strasburg had settled in. When LA got up on him early, I was thinking to myself, you better choke this guy out. You better choke this guy out and this team out while you have the chance. You better bury them. Because if you don't and you let him settle in, you're going to have a big problem. And that's exactly what happened. He did settle in. And then you realize it's not going to be the blowout that Dodger fan thought it was going to be after two innings. That 3-run lead isn't safe at all. Because, and it's already been beaten into the ground, but this Nationals team is tough as hell. They don't turtle, they don't rattle, they don't intimidate. They're going to stay in the fight. More on staying in the fight later on. But they were going to stay in the fight. And to beat them, you have to kill them. We should know this much about the Nats by now. To beat them, you have to kill them. And the Dodgers had their chance early on, but they couldn't do it. Then Anthony Rendon led off the top of the sixth with a double. Juan Soto singled. Now it's 3-1 LA. The grip is officially on at the stadium. But Buehler did what a boss does. Double play, strikeout, inning over. It was brass. Really brass. Then in the bottom of the sixth, Cody Bellinger leads off with a single. He steals second. But Strasburg did exactly what Buehler had done before him. Only better. Strikeout, strikeout, strikeout. This guy's tough. Really impressive. The Dodgers, and this is key, the Dodgers waste another opportunity. Runner in scoring position, nobody out, and they get nothing. At that point, you had to know the missed opportunity was going to come back to bite them in the ass. Then came the top of the seventh. nine more outs. You know they're going to be the nine toughest outs ever, but nine more outs. Buehler hits Kurt Suzuki with a pitch. That leaves Suzuki stunned and on the ground for a while. Really scary moment. The kind of moment that can rattle a pitcher, especially a young pitcher. So you wonder what Buehler's going to do with that. How he's going to respond. Well, he gets the next two outs. Then he gives up a walk, and that was it for him. Let's be very clear about this. He did his job. He pitched into the seventh. He left with a 3-1 lead. He handed it to the bullpen to do its job after he did his job. Now, of course, in a Game 5 situation, it's all hands on deck. So Dave Roberts came out, and he made the call. Clayton Kershaw. At that point, everybody in the stadium is holding their breath, right? We've seen Kershaw before in the postseason. Better yet, we've seen Kershaw before coming out of the bullpen in the postseason. He's coming in as a reliever. Two on, two out, two-run game. Everybody in that stadium knows his narrative. Everybody in the world knows his narrative. Most of you had already pre-written your tweets and were just waiting to send because everybody knows that narrative, including Kershaw, who badly wanted the ball anyway.
Now Kershaw has a sign from Smith. The runners lead. The 0-2 to Eaton. Swung on and missed, strike three. That will end the inning. Kershaw comes in, throws three pitches, strikes out Eaton.
And then that place explodes. It exploded because, again, everybody knows the narrative. Kershaw comes in. He's dirty. He's filthy. He gets them out of the inning. It seemed like an enormous weight had been lifted off everybody's shoulders. He was about to take a big step towards rewriting the narrative. Maybe not changing it, but rewriting it. Because now they're six outs away from advancing. Dodger fans feeling it and partying. But still, in the back of your mind, right, you're thinking Kershaw, postseason, out of the bullpen. In the back of your mind, it's got to be there, right? L.A. goes 1-2-3 in the bottom of the seventh. Then comes the eighth. Dodger fans, hate to relive this, and it's going to hurt you a hell of a lot more than it hurts me because I don't root. But I do call it like I see it, and we were about to see an out-and-out catastrophe, starting with Kershaw's first pitch to Rendon.
Kershaw's 1-0 to Rendon, swung on, hit of the air to deep left center field. Taylor going back, warning track, at the wall, he leaps, it is gone, goodbye! Bang, zoom goes Rendon on the second pitch from Clayton Kershaw.
Nats radio, second pitch. Now it's a one-run game. Now there's not a person in that yard who's not in shock, including the guy who allowed that bomb. And as shocking as that was, the next pitch was even worse. Much, much worse.
Here's the pitch. He swings and belts one a deep right center field. Way back. Going. Going. And gone. Goodbye. Halfway up the pavilion. A tremendous game. Tying. Home run by Juan Soto. And this game is all even.
The second Kershaw found his bat, he knew it was gone. Didn't even look back. Back-to-back home runs. Back-to-back pitches. Juan Soto shattered the ball, shattered that stadium from 3-1 to 3-3 in a heartbeat. Kershaw's first three pitches were filthy smoke. His next two flat out smoked. Two of the next three. And just like that, that game was tied. And Kershaw was out of the game. Kenta Maeda comes in. Strikeout, strikeout, strikeout. Joe Kelly in the ninth. Fine. Then Joe Kelly in the tenth. Instead of Kenley Jansen, it didn't go well. Walk, ground rule double, intentional walk. Dave Roberts does not come for Kelly. He later said that he loved the way he was throwing it and that he was his most well-rested reliever. Next up, Howie Kendrick. I hit my guy D-Dub with a text as Kendrick stepped in. And I said, this is not the guy you want to see with a bat in his hand right now. It's not like I needed a crystal ball for that. That's not some genius baseball take. I had seen more than enough of this guy when he played with the Dodgers and the Angels to know how dangerous he was with a bat in his hand. Roberts was thinking, I need a ground ball. I've got a ground ball pitcher. I've got a ground ball hitter. I like my chances. Unfortunately, old Howie got one up in the air.
Kelly's one strike pitch. Swinging a fly ball, center field deep. Bellinger going back to the warning track, to the wall. It's a grand slam. Howie Kendrick has done it. They're going crazy in the Nationals dugout. Howie Kendrick with a grand slam here in the 10th inning of Game 5. The Nationals 7, the Dodgers 3. Do you believe it?
Howie bleeping Kendrick, if you need him. He'd had a brutal series in the field, and he erased it all with one swing of the bat. What a freaking legend. Single-handedly ripped the heart out of every Dodger fan who's ever lived. Snatched every last one of their souls. Let me tell you something. That was some Jack Clark, Tom Niedenfuhr stuff right there, for you old schoolers. Up 3-1 at the start of the eighth. Down 7-3 in the 10th. The best team in the National League all season. The best regular season team in Dodger history. The team that was finally going to get it done. The crew that was finally going to get over. This was the year where the Dodgers finally finished and shut everybody the hell up. Instead, they implode in the most spectacular fashion ever. Everybody rushing in to dump gasoline on that gigantic dumpster fire where Chavis Ravine stood only an hour earlier. And everybody in that clubhouse knows it, starting with Clayton Kershaw.
Everything people say is true right now about the postseason. I understand that.
How do you not feel for that guy? And I know a lot of you don't, but how do you not feel for that guy? Especially given who he is and what he makes. I know a lot of you don't. But he's a class dude. He's a stand-up guy. And once again, he had the worst possible night at the worst possible time. But to his credit, he was stand-up and he owned it. A lot of other guys would deny the narrative. A lot of other guys would say, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. You never played the game. A lot of other guys would duck out altogether. Kershaw didn't do any of that. He owned it completely. And no, he's not the pitcher he once was. No, he should not have been out there. Yes, the narrative is fair. The narrative is accurate. For whatever reason, this future Hall of Famer isn't just mortal in the postseason. He's imminently hittable. So those back-to-back home runs, as stunning as they were, really were not stunning at all. Not when you consider this guy had never given up back-to-back home runs in a regular season game, but has now done it twice in the postseason. So, of course, that's the narrative. And, of course, it's going to stick to him, and it should. He knows it. And it's going to raise a hell of a lot of questions about Dave Roberts. Lots of questions, starting with what was he doing going to Kershaw anyway? Look, on the surface, that answer's pretty obvious. Would you like to bring in a Hall of Famer in a must-win game? Every damn day? Well, maybe not every time. Not if that Hall of Famer is Clayton Kershaw. Then the answer should be no. And I say that because he had so many other options. I say that as somebody who's got nothing but respect for Kershaw as a pitcher. One of the greatest you're ever going to see. That's not an exaggeration. A surefire Hall of Famer. A generational type pitcher. But in this case, it should have been a case of what have you done for me lately. Not what have you done in the past. Because the truth is, the only reason he was in that game was because of the name on the back of his jersey and his reputation. And not for what he's done lately. Especially when his fastball and his slider no longer have gap in speed. And when he's been getting guys out with his brain more than his arm. Roberts trusted him. Roberts is loyal to him. Roberts believed Kershaw would get it done. And it came back to bite both of them. But I want to be clear about this too. Kershaw was not the only problem. It's just that there were a number of options better than him. From Kenta Maeda, who was filthy when he came in. Pedro Baez. But it wasn't just Kershaw who came into that game in that spot. It's that Joe Kelly stayed in the game after the ninth. Don't get me wrong. He was great in the ninth. But he was a disaster in the tenth. He would tell you that himself. Kelly had not gone longer than an inning in a month and a half. Yet there he was in the tenth of an elimination game. That is the worst time to try to stretch that guy out. And because there were other options. But Dave Roberts said, if you want to blame me, you go right ahead.
If the blame falls on me, I've got no problem with it.
So if you want to blame him, go ahead. If you want to blame Kershaw and Kelly, go ahead. They all picked bad nights to have bad nights. But there is more blame to go around. Cody Bellinger, the likely MVP, hit 211. No home runs, no runs batted in. Corey Seager hit 150. As a team, they hit 220. You could not ask for a team to handle a gutting loss better than the Dodgers. But as the Dodger haters will point out, yeah, they're good at it. They've got a lot of practice with it. That's catastrophe. That is a disaster. That could not have gone any worse. The type of thing that they'll hope to get beyond, but trust me, they're never getting over. And tip your hat to the Nats. They are tough as hell. They outplayed, outpitched, outclutched, outclassed, outmanaged LA. They deserve to advance. And if you ask them, they'll tell you they're not done yet. As for LA, it's going to be a really interesting offseason because the regular season could not have gone any better, and now that does not matter at all. Nobody's going to remember a thing they did during the regular season because of what happened last night at Chavez Ravine. All right, so if you're anything like me, you're probably looking to get better and faster and have a cleaner source of natural energy and nutrition. I'm guessing you're looking for that. Well, the good news is I've done the research for you and I found it. It comes in the form of Athletic Greens. Athletic Greens Ultimate Daily is the obsessively researched all-in-one nutritional support powder containing 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food ingredients. It's so easy. You just take one scoop and you mix it into 10 ounces of water and get a jump start on feeling your best every single day. I do this for breakfast all the time. And if you're on the road or you're away from home, the travel packs make it really easy to keep up that same healthy routine because there's no need to carry around multiple pill bottles. Simply put, Athletic Greens can help you feel amazing every single day, no matter where you are and no matter what life throws at you. No compromises, no harmful chemicals, no artificial colors, no sweeteners, no added sugar, no GMOs. Athletic Greens Ultimate Dailies are also gluten and dairy free. They're vegan, paleo, and keto friendly. If you struggle to get in nutrient-dense fruit and veggies, or you don't feel as good as you used to, then Athletic Greens is here to help. And right now, you can jump on over to athleticgreens.com/Rome and claim my special offer. 20 free travel packs valued at $79 with your first purchase. Once again, athleticgreens.com/Rome. Go there right now. Athletic Greens, start your day right, good things follow. Something bad happened to L.A. last night, so I had to find a Los Angeles legend. He is a longtime friend of the program, Arash Markazi. Arash, what's going on, brother?
Jim, how are you?
Good, good, man. How are you?
You know, I'm okay. I didn't expect to transition into the Lakers and Clippers season quite so quickly, but that's okay.
Boy, that's the truth, isn't it? So why don't we just go frame by frame or piece by piece? You were at the stadium last night, and you're someone who has always had his finger on the pulse of LA fans. How would you describe the vibe in the stadium before that first pitch?
Very excited. This fan base loves Walker. They believe he is the next great pitcher for this team. I think there was this feeling of, listen, I don't know if this fan base knew if they were going to win the World Series, but they expected to get to the World Series. You know, that would have been a tough matchup against Houston. But after a 106-win season, I don't think anyone thought that this journey was going to finish prior to that. I think if everyone expected them to get to the World Series, it was a matter of, you know, would they play the Yankees? Would they play Houston? So while they weren't happy to be playing a Game 5, I don't think there was anyone too nervous. I think everyone thought that they were going to find a way to win.
And then, Arash, they get off to a great start. Walker Buehler goes 1-2-3 in the first. The Dodger bats go to work on Steven Strasburg. L.A. leads off the bottom of the second with a home run. Now it's 3-0. Walker's rolling. The bats have come alive. So if we're being honest, at that point, were you expecting L.A. to just handle business the rest of the way?
Yes, I was booking my flight to St. Louis, was booking my hotel to St. Louis. That is, by the way, what reporters do in the press box. You got to plan ahead. So, yes, at that point, making arrangements for a flight to St. Louis, obviously games 1 and 2 would have been in Los Angeles. So I was just talking about games 3, 4, 5. But I will tell you, Jim, when Clayton Kershaw comes in and he gets out of the seventh, there was a feeling that that was what his job was for that day. When he came back to the mound, and, you know, you hate to second guess, but this was real-time second guessing. There was this feeling of, what is Clayton Kershaw doing back on the mound? And, you know, and again, for him to be in that position, it's either he could have kind of reversed this kind of playoff Kershaw trending topic or lived up to it. Or I don't want to say lived up to it, but lived it down to it. And for him to give up that home run, that was bad, Jim. But when he stayed on the mound for Soto, and then for the second time in his career, he had never done this during the season, gives up back-to-back home runs on back-to-back pitches, I couldn't believe it.
We're talking about Rosh Marcozzi. You're so right. And I made that point, too, that it's so unusual, but it's not that unusual. It's stunning, but it's not stunning. He had never given up back-to-back home runs in the regular season, yet now he's done it twice in the postseason. So when he comes back out and Anthony Rendon hits that homer to make it 3-2, what was the mood like in the stadium at that point?
The mood was, oh, my God, here it is, playoff Kershaw. You know, that always becomes like a trending topic come playoff time if he has a poor performance. You have to realize, though, with his history and his mindset, and really he's not the same player that he was a few years ago, you have to pull him. Like this is not let him recover and find himself. So if there are two moments that I can blame Dave for, Dave Roberts, and say, listen, I realize what the spreadsheets say and what you guys have talked about and planned about and whatnot. For Clayton Kershaw to stay on the mound for Soto after giving that home run, that was ridiculous. No excuse for that. And then you fast forward to Joe Kelly, the bases loaded, and we'd seen what Joe Kelly had done during the course of this season. And really, in the previous time that he had, for him to be on the mound during that situation, I mean, those were two moments that, regardless of how they played out, in the press box, in the crowd, people are wondering, what the heck is he doing out there?
We're talking about Rosh Marcozzi. I think that's fair. And I'm a big Dave Roberts guy, Rosh. I'm not even saying that this should cost him his job. In fact, I think it shouldn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, as bad a night as Dave Roberts had, and he had a really, really bad night at the worst possible time, I think he deserves another shot. But at the same time, I'm not going to Kershaw at all. Once Kershaw gets his out, I'm not going back to him. Once he gives up that home run, I'm getting him the hell out of there. And Joe Kelly, he did his job in the ninth. I would not have brought him back for another inning. But then the Howie Kendrick home run, Arash, the grand slam, what kind of an impact did that have in the stadium? Were the fans heading for the exit even before that ball landed?
I mean, because it was hit so true that it was gone. And yeah, as soon as that ball left the yard, people were beginning to head out. And it was a different feel, though, Jim. You know, they had lost the back-to-back World Series on their home field. But in the crowd and really in the clubhouse, too, there were more tears than I had seen before. There was more long hugs goodbye because they realized they're not going to come back as the same team. Certain guys are going to retire. Certain guys are going to leave. This was a special group that really felt, listen, they had 12 walk-off wins. They thought for sure they were going to find a way to win. And then for them not to win and for their season to come to an end like this, it was heartbreaking for them.
So, Arash, you know how angry Dodger fans are going to be because this team was so good. It had so much potential. So what do you think the organization does in response? Do they maybe add a piece or two and just run it back next season? Or because they fell short the way they did, do you think there's going to be a serious shakeup?
I think you're right about Dave. I think Dave returns just because, listen, he had a bad night, but he's been a fantastic guy for this team. So I do think he will come back. The bullpen, Jim, since this whole run began, they have not gotten some help there. So, you know, when you look back to 2017, a four-run lead, two four-run leads blown by Kershaw. Last night, 3-1 lead, six outs away. You got to get some help there. And so, listen, they've tried to do it slowly, bringing up their guys. I mean, this is a very strong core group that will come back. This team has been built for long-term success. That being said, you got to get some help there and kind of maybe go all in, you know, for 1 year, because it's been 31 years they have not won the World Series. And so perhaps make a move that you would not that you wouldn't make because you have to do this.
So, Rosh, Kershaw, Kelly, Roberts, they all had bad nights. We've talked about this. The bullpen certainly has some question marks. The one thing before I let you go that we haven't talked about, some key Dodger bats were pretty quiet in the series. How much blame do they deserve?
A lot. And, Jim, that's not going to get talked about because of these high-pressure moments and these kind of series-shifting moments. But Cody Pellinger and Corey Seager and so many other guys who really come up big for them during the course of this season and during the run, not performing. I mean, listen, at the end of the day, they could have had that walk-off home run. They could have found a way to win that game. And so, listen, it is a team game, and then for them not to win, it's not just because of Kershaw, but unfortunately for Kershaw, like, that's what he will be defined by. And so, listen, a lot of people hold blame, but Kershaw will get the brunt of it for sure.
So a quick follow then. I mean, this is part of the narrative, understandably so. He's owning it. He says what they say about me in the postseason is true. But when you look at the options, Arash, that Dave Roberts had in that bullpen, like Maeda, like Baez, we can keep going on. Why do you think he then went with Kershaw and then stayed with him?
I think there's a personal connection that he has with him that he did not want to pull him there. He wanted him to have that moment. And the problem is, Jim, at that moment, you got to forget that it's Clayton Kershaw. You got to do what's best for the team. And what's best for the team was not to keep Kershaw there. And so it is so frustrating to see Kershaw go through this because he's had such a great career. And so for him to be defined by this is tough. But you just mentioned it. It's not like he had to stay with Kershaw. He had Kenta Maeda. He had Kenley Jansen. He had guys that he could go to. And so for him to stay with Clayton Kershaw when that was so clearly the wrong decision, that's why he's being talked about today. And people are saying he should not come back. And again, you mentioned it. I think he will come back. But a terrible move for sure.
You know, I think so. I think it was not a good move. I think he should not have gone to him, but there was a loyalty issue. And I'm telling you, Arash, I think you and I might be swimming upstream. In fact, I know I am. Nobody is saying that he should come back. I think he should.
No, I know.
But we'll see. He's calm. Yeah.
It's so tough for him, yeah.
No, I agree. It is tough, and it's a bad night and a bad look, and the optics are terrible, and it looks like it was a personal relationship that bit them both. But I think if you look at the entire track record, he's done a great job there. He is a columnist for the LA Times. He is a Los Angeles legend. He is a very good friend of this program, a longtime friend, Arash Markazi. Arash, great to have you on. Thanks so much. We'll talk some basketball with you soon.
I would love that. Thanks so much, Jim.
Today's episode of the Jim Rohn Podcast is brought to you by CBS Sports HQ, the brand new streaming sports news network. It's live 24/7. It costs you nothing. That's right, nothing. Sports coverage that is always on and always free. It costs you nothing. It looks great. It sounds great. The intel is amazing. And the price is even better. Nothing. CBS Sports HQ's coverage is always focused on the game. Tons of highlights, breaking news as it happens, fantasy advice, and something we care about deeply here, gambling picks and analysis to get that extra edge. Look, I know when I turn on CBS Sports HQ, I'm going to get tips and trends that I need to win my bets. I want that. We all want that. And don't forget, you get this access to this amazing coverage free. I don't mean free for a week or a month or if you've got some special cable package. It is totally and completely free for everybody. You don't even need a login. Just download the CBS Sports app on your phone, Apple TV, Roku, Fire TV, or other connected device at any time and watch CBS Sports HQ. No fake debates. Just sports for real sports fans at the great price of nothing. You don't even have to log in or sign up for anything at all. Just download the CBS Sports app and watch CBS Sports HQ today. My brother, Iafredi. Iafredi, what's going on?
Hey, how you doing, Jimmy?
Good, good. Ken, how about you?
Yeah, I've been better, but, you know, I'm trying to stay inside here in Los Angeles because I don't want to get hit on the head by people jumping out of buildings, you know, and I have to say, I'm good with almost everything you're saying about last night, but on two key points, Jim, just no. I mean, love you, brother, but no. Okay, point number one, Dave Roberts should not be fired. Jim, okay, this is not your first time to the rodeo. Okay, you've been around, and you've seen way more than your share of coaches who know how to create excellent conditions for talented players to win lots of games. But when it comes time to earn their keep by making big-time decisions, they just can't do it. And so let there be no doubt. Dodger manager Marty Schottenheimer has got to go. And if you think that I'm just talking about last night, Jim, you are sorely mistaken. This dude makes Clayton Kershaw look like Mad Bum when it comes to October performance. I mean, at least Kersh has the occasional World Series game won in 2017, all right? Please direct my attention, Jim, to the big postseason win where Crafty Marty outsmarted the other manager and got the Dodgers a win the other team deserved. Okay, you can't because he never has, and he won't because he can't. Here is a dude who has been glaringly outmanaged in at least four of the last five postseason series he has managed. Okay, there's last night, but there's game four of last year's World Series. I was at that game. And if not for Marty, that series is tied 2-2, and it is anybody's trophy. And then there's last year's NLCS, where Craig Counsell managed circles around poor Marty. Remember Miley pitching to one batter and torching the entire Dodgers platoon scheme? And there's Dave going, whoa, what the hell just happened? Okay. And then there's Game 7 of the 2017 World Series, when apparently everybody in baseball except Marty knew that Yu Darvish was announcing what pitch he was about to throw. And now Baez this year. I mean, is there some reason, Jim, why the Dodgers coaching staff seems to be the last one to find out that their pitchers are tipping? Okay, that's four series out of five where Marty has been full-on pantsed by the other guy. There is no reason to think that's going to change, Jim, and the Dodgers are too young and too good to keep winning 100-plus games every year and getting outmanaged in the postseason. It is time for somebody who knows how to make a decision in the heat of the fire. That's one. As for point two, the Nats not getting enough credit, Jim, really, I mean, practically everybody is anointing them the little engine that could. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't be credited for hanging around long enough for Marty to make every decision they had been dreaming he would make for 6 2/3 innings. But if it's true that Dave Roberts made inexcusable decisions, then it can't also be true that the Nats aren't getting enough credit. They deserve some credit, but certainly no more than they're already getting. And honesty demands that we pause for a second and acknowledge something that literally nobody is talking about. If Will Smith's hack in the bottom of the ninth goes 10 more feet, 10 stinking feet, you and everybody else are saying this today. Let's credit the Nats. They hung around for as long as they could, trying to win a series with just three pitchers. But sooner or later, having no bullpen is generally considered a liability in October, and that's why the Nats are headed home and why the Dodgers are now the 2019 team of destiny following walk-off number 13. 10 feet. Now, I get it. His shot didn't have the 10 extra feet, and that's baseball. But game of inches? How about game of millimeters, Jim, when it comes to where the Fresh Prince's bat lined up with that ball? Okay, so yes, scoreboard never lies. That doesn't mean we have to lie. The Nats did what it took, and Marty tried his best to give them every opportunity to do so. But no team with that bullpen is winning a World Series, Jim. And when the Nats flame out, it is only going to make this loss hurt even worse for Dodger Nation. Dave needs to be what I am, Jim. Out.
I am Frady. Matt in L.A. What's up, Matt?
Romy Rome, thanks for the vine. From Manhattan Beach to Montreal, from Whittier to Washington, D.C., you're welcome. Now, as I address the jungle and the media conglomerate that is the CBS Sports Net, a global enterprise, scoreboard, look up at it, Matt. Congratulations to Howie Kendrick. Congratulations to the Washington Nationals, the Montreal Expos, hell, even the Washington Senators, and everybody in D.C. not named Fat-Faced Jake Rudin can get some gap today. Because they earned it, pimp. Earned it by dropping my Dodgers like Jeff in Richmond's swollen jowls. But that's not why I called, Jim. I called because the Blue Crew got smashed by a combo plate of reverse jungle karma appetizer that won Walker Buehler allegedly unintentionally stiffing the jungle birth, followed by a double entree of Clayton Kerosene Kershaw's arm. Once Buehler's no-show let the toothpaste out of the tube, reversing the Dodgers' accrued jungle karma so that in one fell swoop, that overhyped, overpriced, overrated regular season ripper who becomes a playoff pariah every damn October reared his beach ball tossing, rabbinical beard rocking, expired Clayton Kerosene Kershaw, perpetual playoff failure is absolutely done. Stick a fork in them like Billy Clarkson sticking a barbecue fork in a Cornish hen or 12. I'm done with that loser Kershaw, Vance. It's still the Dodgers till I die. Still Dave Roberts all day, but I can't cheer for that Cy Young collecting paper champ puke ever again. Can't do it. Where it's Rick Eisenhower inviting the young men of the XR4 TI crew to a speakeasy. Where James Kelly's great gazoo-esque helmet dome and broomstick arms. Unwore Mike Golick Jr. being on TV and not knowing how to tuck in a damn shirt. Fat slob. Shape up. Outro.
Rack him. Matt in L.A. Steve Clifford is my guest. Steve, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Doing well, Jim. Great to be back with you.
Good to have you back, Steve. Thanks for making time. You know, when you and I spoke after you were hired, we talked about what you liked best about that job. If I told you then, Steve, that in season one, you'd go from 25 wins to 42, and you'd reach the postseason, and you'd win the first game against the eventual champs, what would you have said if I said that to you back then?
I would say we'll take it. And then I think especially the way the guys played from the beginning of the season where, you know, we really struggled offensively and we made great progress throughout the year. And you know, we went, you know, we played our way in, which was good for our belief, great for our team. And having the experience to play in the playoffs was a big deal for us.
You know, to be specific about that too, Steve, you did play your way in because you went 22-9 down the stretch. In the last 34 games of the year, you were number one in the league in defense. What was the biggest difference then from the start of the season to the end? And did it feel like a switch was flipped and that things clicked for the guys?
For sure. And it was actually gradual. But I would say as much as anything, it was less mistakes. We have a very talented defensive roster. We have size, positional size. We have versatility. And as you know, having the ability to switch, pick and roll, dribble handoffs, flash action in this league so you stay out of rotation has become a bigger and bigger deal with, you know, teams playing four out, five out. You just don't get spread out as much. And the Aaron Gordons, Evan Fournier's, Jonathan Isaac's, they allow us. Our defense is actually very simple. They can all guard a lot of different guys, and that's really what our defense is built around.
Steve Clifford joining us, and that's critical in that league, right? You got to have that versatility, that ability to switch, and the defense played so, so well. In terms of the offense, you said that it was not necessarily where you needed it to be after watching that series. What kind of things did you see in the offense that led you to feel that way?
I would think that if you go back to most coaching staffs, head coach, assistants alike, after you lose a playoff series, I would bet most of the time that one of the first things as you're evaluating that you would say is we didn't have enough aspects of offense that were good enough. And that's what happened to us, in my opinion, more than anything else against Toronto. And they were terrific defensively, but you've got to have ways that you can put pressure on the defense, simply put, and create quality offensive chances over 48 minutes against teams like that. And, you know, we had stretches where we were good, but we have to develop a team offensive game where, you know, we can post it, we can pick and roll it, we can play flash, we have cutting options. And that's what you have to have in this league now to be able to play against the better defensive teams.
Orlando Magic head coach Steve Clifford breaking it down for us. So you have a 17-win improvement. You get a trip to the postseason. That, to me, feels like a huge step in 1 year. So what would the next step look like, and what are the signs that you're looking for to tell you that your team is ready to make that next step?
Well, I think more balanced play. You know, our goal really defensively, we were good at the things that are most important. You know, we didn't get scored a lot in transition. We were a good defensive rebounding team. We didn't foul a lot. And we protected the paint. So all those things are critical. And to the defensive part of our game, we have to be able to create more offense with our defense. We didn't steal the ball a lot. We're bottom three in the league. And we didn't score points off steals and turnovers. And we've got to get to that level now. We're going to be more aggressive with some of our coverages. And we've also picked up, you know, Al-Farouq Aminu, who can do that. And then Markelle Fultz, who also is a guy that can create offense with his defense. And then at the offensive end, you know, simply put, we've got to be more inside out. You know, basketball is a game of penetration. And the nights when we could get the ball going towards the basket, into the paint, we got fouled more, we shot more layups, and we shot more open threes. And in a nutshell, those are the things that we have to improve.
We're talking to Steve Clifford. I'm glad you mentioned Aminu. One of the new faces is Al-Farouq Aminu. And from talking to Terry Stotts over the years, I know how much he loved what Chief brings to the floor and in the locker room. How excited are you, and what can he mean to your team?
I think he can help us in every phase. You know, he's a professional. He's rock solid. He's got high IQ. And obviously, he's experienced playing in big games, in big playoff series, deep into the playoffs as a major part of a team. And he's come in here, and I think he's helped us already just by the things that you spoke about, by his character, by his work ethic, and just kind of the nature of who he is.
Steve, you mentioned Markelle Fultz. Let me ask you about him. He played his first NBA game since November. What did you make of his performance, and what's it been like to work with him so far?
He's been great, and he's done a good job of, I think, Jeff Waltman, our president here, John Hammond, our general manager. When Markelle came here, the whole plan was to just take it step by step, and you know, he had some knee issues. He had obviously the shoulder issue, and he's done a great job with his rehab. He's done a great job on the court, and you know, he's only played 33 games in 2 years, but he's healthy now. He's a good worker. He's got very high IQ. To be honest, when I watch him, you know, I recruited at DC area for years, and he plays to me like a DC point guard. High IQ, tough-minded, and a guy that can get to be a good player at both ends of the floor.
You know, it's interesting what you said about a DC point guard. It seems to me he's been subjected to a ton of scrutiny, fairly or unfairly, both in traditional media and social media. He's talked about how much it means to him to have guys in his own locker room that have his back. As a team, you're going to coach him, and you're going to have expectations for him. But how much of what you also do for him is just kind of helping free him of those burdens and letting him be himself again?
Oh, that's a big part of it. And that was, again, the plan that Jeff and John put forward. And with all that, I think everybody here is supportive of him. And it's easy to do because he's high character. He has natural work habits, and he has a love of the game. And I think he's enjoying himself. I think he's feeling better and better physically. And he's going to be a big part of our team.
You know, you and your staff, I know, love to break down film, and you've said that you learned that part of it, or at least part of that, from Pat Riley. Like, Pat Riley would be asked a question after a game, and before he'd give you a complete answer, he'd say, listen, I got to preface this by saying, I need to see the film first. I need to see it. How much did you learn from him in terms of the importance of film as a tool for coaching?
Yeah, well, my first year in the NBA was with the Knicks, working for Jeff Van Gundy, and I remember I would always go to Coach Riley's press conferences after games, and then also to Coach Brown's, just because, I mean, you could learn things just from listening to them. And they lost in Cleveland one night, Miami, and that was the quote that always stuck with me. They asked him something about the offense, and he said, look, I'll give you a general idea, but you never really know until you watch the film. And, you know, working for the Van Gundys, obviously Jeff and Stan, I mean, they're the at the highest level of breaking down film and being detailed. And so it's one thing to me, and I think it makes sense, is it's easy to have a good practice in this league, but it's not always easy to make progress because, you know, if you're not breaking down film and you don't know exactly what is wrong offensively or defensively, you can go in and spend your time, you know, not working on the things you need to. And as much as anything, like the quote I got from Coach Riley and then working for the Van Gundys, that's really become you know, my belief in a lot of what we do here.
Yeah, Steve, you mentioned Larry Brown, too. Going back to the 90s, I used to have him on this show, and I never, ever spoke to anybody quite like Larry Brown. Like, he would just put it all out there. He'd wear his heart on his sleeve, and he would answer every single question. I'd be hard-pressed to find a better coach than Larry Brown on any level. What made him so unique? Was it his ability to teach the game or something else?
Oh, you know, my experiences with him were, you know, the first ones were the AI, Mutombo, Eric Snow teams when they went to the finals and lost to the Lakers. And I would say, I mean, I just think that he's one of the greatest, whatever you want to say, top five, top 10 coaches of our time. Great defensive coach. Incredible detail at the offensive end. They always play to their strengths, fundamentally sound, and a great game coach. Great with after timeout plays, special situations. You know, I never had the privilege to work with him, but I can say again, when I was a scout, I would look forward to watching those teams play.
Steve Clifford is my guest. How about one thought about Pat Riley? What he seemed like a guy also that, I mean, aside from that motivational genius and that fire, man, guys, like even the players thought that he was like cool and had a different kind of swagger for a head coach. How was he able to reach guys the way he did?
Well, I, you know, talked to Patrick a lot, Ewing, about that. And I think that, you know, I would say that, you know, he had natural leadership qualities. You know, the strength of his convictions, a strong philosophy. And like Patrick always said, that there were just certain things that I think, like Jeff did with Patrick, that that Coach Riley would fight him on, you know, posting the ball deeper, you know, some of the decisions at the offensive end, whatever it was. And I think that's what all the great coaches do.
He's entering his second season as head coach of the Orlando Magic. They had a great first year, a 17-win improvement last year, went to the postseason for the first time since 2012. A jungle favorite, Steve Clifford. Steve, so good to have you back, and I always appreciate that visit. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.